Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. This is the second part of a two-part exploration of the court's unanimous June 19th decision in Mittal v. Tam, the case about the Asian-American rock band The Slants and their battle with the Patent and Trademark Office to register a trademark on their band name. In our last episode, we looked at Simon Tam's path to the Supreme Court and explored how the case fits into broader cultural conversations about offensive speech. In this episode, we're going to look at the legal arguments in the case and what the Supreme Court ultimately decided. But first, a quick refresher to bring everyone up to speed. The Slants is an all-Asian American rock band founded over a decade ago by bass player Simon Tam. The term slant, short for slant eye, is a derogatory term for East Asians, but Tam chose the name not to insult, but to proudly celebrate his and his fellow band members' Asian heritage. Tam applied to the Patent and Trademark Office for a trademark on the name The Slants, but the PTO denied his application under Section 2A of the Lanham Act, the primary trademark statute, which prohibits registration of, among other things, any trademark, quote, which may disparage or falsely suggest a connection with persons living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute. According to the PTO, the word slants disparages Asians, and therefore it can't be registered. Tam appealed the PTO's decision to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, arguing that the denial violated his First Amendment rights. The Federal Circuit agreed and ruled for Tam. The PTO, then headed by Michelle Lee, asked the Supreme Court to hear the case. The court took the case, which was then called Lee v. Tam. Now let's look at the legal arguments that the parties made to the court, starting with the government. First, the government argued that trademark denial doesn't involve a restriction on speech, so the First Amendment isn't even implicated. If you listened to last episode, you may remember that the PTO relied on this argument to reject Tam's application. Even without a trademark, Tam is free to use the Slants name as a band name, on its albums, its website, on merchandise. Tam wants to reclaim a slur and repurpose it as a positive statement of his heritage, but he doesn't need a registered trademark for that, and in fact, the Slants have been performing under the name for years without a registered trademark. So, the government says, the trademark registration denial doesn't actually restrict any speech. Tam responds that while it is true that he can continue to use the name without trademark registration, he's denied the valuable benefits that come with registration. This loss of benefits might dissuade some speakers from using an unregisterable name, and even if Tam's speech is completely unchanged by the lack of registration, he's effectively being penalized by the government for his speech. The government next argued that the act of registering a trademark should actually be considered the government's own speech rather than the speech of a private party. Why does it make this argument? The First Amendment doesn't apply when the government itself is the speaker. The First Amendment limits the government's ability to restrict the speech of private parties and often requires the government to treat speech in a neutral and even-handed way. But when the government is not regulating private parties, but is instead speaking on its own behalf, it has no obligation to be neutral. The government has policies and programs and objectives, and it often speaks in support of these. Think, for example, of government advertising campaigns promoting public transportation or discouraging smoking. Presidents, governors, and other public officials can, and frequently do, make speeches taking sides on divisive issues. But when is speech connected with a government program considered the government's own speech? In 2015, the Supreme Court decided a case called Walker v. Texas Division Sons of Confederate Veterans. This case involved a Texas specialty license plate program, which allowed private parties to propose custom license plate designs. In some states, the state legislature individually approves a small number of specialty license plate designs. In Texas, by contrast, proposals can be submitted to the Department of Motor Vehicles, which had approved over 350 designs, including such things as a plate featuring a can of Dr. Pepper and logos for a number of out-of-state colleges. The Sons of Confederate Veterans sued after Texas rejected their specialty plate application because their logo prominently features the Confederate battle flag. At the Supreme Court, a 5-justice majority ruled for Texas, holding that the specialty license plates are government speech, not private speech, and therefore Texas is free to accept or reject whatever message it wants. Justice Alito wrote a 4-justice dissent arguing, among other things, that it was fanciful to characterize the range of speech conveyed in the hundreds of specialty plate designs as the official speech of the state government. The court's decision surprised proponents of broad free speech rights because it was a relatively rare loss from a court that's seen as highly protective of speech, and the case quickly became a favorite of governments defending speech restrictions related to government programs. Here, the federal government argued that registration of a trademark, like the approval of a Texas specialty plate, should be considered government speech and not subject to First Amendment protection. The government also argued that trademarks should be considered commercial speech. Under the court's First Amendment precedents, commercial speech is a special category. It does receive a considerable degree of protection, but under a standard dating back to a 1980 Supreme Court case called Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corp. v. Public Service Commission, the government has additional latitude to regulate commercial speech when the restriction substantially advances an important government interest. A great deal of speech is commercial in one sense. A newspaper like the New York Times, for example, is sold to consumers for money by a for-profit corporation. But under the Supreme Court's precedents, that's not considered commercial speech, and speech sold for money can still be fully protected. Instead, the reduced First Amendment protection for commercial speech is confined to speech that proposes a commercial transaction, in other words, advertising. Here, the government argued that trademarks, which exist to identify products and producers in the marketplace, are inherently commercial speech, and the disparagement provision served the important interest of protecting the orderly flow of commerce from disruption caused by trademarks that support discrimination. Tam argued that despite their connection to commerce, trademarks serve important non-commercial expressive functions. When a band chooses a name or logo, it is engaging in self-expression. Trademarks regularly convey political or ideological messages, whether subtly or overtly, and are engaged in public conversation that goes well beyond simply identifying the source of goods or services. As an overall response to all of the government's theories, Tam argued that the disparagement provision is impermissible viewpoint-based discrimination. What does this mean? There are different ways that the government might restrict speech, and some are more acceptable than others. Sometimes speech is restricted without regard to the content of the speech. For example, protests in a public park might be limited to daytime hours, or speaker systems might be limited to a maximum decibel level. Rules like this, which don't depend on the content of the speech being regulated, are known as time, place, and manner restrictions, and the government can often impose them as long as it leaves open ample alternative means of expression. When the government regulates speech on the basis of what it says, a so-called content-based restriction, the First Amendment imposes more limitations. But certain types of content-based regulation can be acceptable. For example, when the government itself provides a venue for speech, it can often be limited to certain topics. If the local school board holds a special forum for public comment about the district's athletic programs, speakers could be prohibited from talking about unrelated issues like the cafeteria menu or the science curriculum. But one specific type of content-based restriction is especially disfavored under the First Amendment. These are so-called viewpoint-based restrictions, where the government attempts to limit speech based on the specific opinions being expressed. For example, allowing pro-choice speech while prohibiting pro-life speech, or permitting Republican speakers while barring Democrats. When the government discriminates against speech or speakers on the basis of viewpoint, it acts constitutionally only if it can show that the regulation is necessary and narrowly drawn to serve a compelling interest. But in practice, a finding of viewpoint-based discrimination is nearly always fatal to speech regulations. Tam argues that prohibiting registration of disparaging trademarks is blatant viewpoint-based discrimination. The government disagreed, arguing that the provision was actually viewpoint-neutral. First, because it broadly applied to disparagement of all persons rather than singling out certain favored groups. And second, because it applied to a disparaging term like slants, regardless of whether it was intended to demean and insult Asians or was intended as in-group self-affirmation. Perhaps surprisingly, the Supreme Court had never squarely answered this question, and the lower courts were divided on it, with several courts upholding similar speech restrictions that banned demeaning or disparaging language. Tam also argued that the disparagement provision is unconstitutionally vague. There's a legal doctrine known as void for vagueness, which says that a law is invalid if it is too vague. The doctrine serves two purposes. First, it ensures that people have fair notice of what is and is not allowed so they can act accordingly. And second, it protects against arbitrary or discriminatory enforcement against disfavored individuals or groups. When dealing with speech regulation, courts often refer to the chilling effects of vague restrictions. Uncertainty will cause even permissible speech to be chilled. Speakers will steer clear of even potentially prohibited speech because they can't be sure of where the line will be drawn. For example, a business seeking to trademark the name of a new product risks wasting valuable time and money developing a brand if that mark might ultimately be rejected as disparaging. It may avoid choosing a particular name, even a name that would have been found non-disparaging, because it can't afford the risk that the PTO might decide otherwise. In support of Tam's argument, amicus briefs quoted the PTO itself describing the disparagement standard as highly subjective and provided a laundry list of offensive trademarks that had received the PTO's blessing over the years. Before we move on, I want to briefly mention one final argument from Tam that wasn't based on the First Amendment, but only on the disparagement provision itself. Tam argued that when the Act referred to trademarks that disparage, quote, persons, this refers only to legal persons, that is, individual people, corporations, nonprofits, and the like, but does not refer to indefinite groups like a race or ethnicity. So, under this interpretation, even if the name the slants does disparage Asians, this isn't covered by the disparagement provision. On January 18th, the court heard oral argument, and the justices asked tough questions of both sides. The justices were highly critical of the government's position and seemed somewhat more sympathetic to Tam, but were clearly concerned about the potential implications of ruling for him. Most commentators predicted a victory for Tam, but it was anyone's guess what grounds the court's decision would ultimately rely on. On June 19th, the court handed down its decision in the case. But before we dig into the opinions, a quick word about the case name. I mentioned earlier that the Lee in the case name Lee v. Tam was Michelle Lee, the director of the Patent and Trademark Office at the time the case arrived at the Supreme Court. Less than 2 weeks before the Supreme Court issued its decision, Lee resigned suddenly from her position at the top of the PTO. Soon after, Joseph Mittal took over as interim director of the PTO. Under the Supreme Court's rules, when a government officer who is a party to a case in an official capacity resigns or otherwise leaves office, he or she is automatically replaced by the successor in office. So, Lee v. Tam became Mittal v. Tam. With that out of the way, on to the opinions. Because the case was argued before Justice Gorsuch joined the court, he didn't participate in the decision. The remaining eight justices ruled unanimously for Tam, but the court was divided over the reason into two four-justice factions. In a typical Supreme Court decision, one justice writes an opinion joined by a majority of the justices, and this is designated the opinion of the court. Other justices may add their own concurring or dissenting opinions, but the majority's opinion, the opinion of the court, is the official statement of the law that's viewed as binding by lower courts. Here, however, there was no opinion joined in its entirety by a majority of the court. Justice Alito wrote one opinion, parts of which were joined by all or almost all of the justices, but the rest of which carried only four justices. The portions of Alito's opinion that had an actual majority are designated the opinion of the court, but the rest of his opinion is not. Justice Kennedy wrote a concurring opinion for the other four justices, and Justice Thomas, who joined most of Alito's opinion, wrote a concurrence expressing his own views. Decisions like this, without a single clear opinion of the court, are often referred to as splintered or fractured majorities, and as we'll discuss a little later, they make it difficult to figure out what binding precedent is. Let's look at what the different opinions said, starting with the common ground. Justice Alito's opinion of the court begins by considering Tam's argument that Section 2A doesn't even apply to the slants because the disparagement provision doesn't apply to amorphous groups like races, but only to legal persons like individuals or corporate entities. The court quickly rejected this argument, noting first that a trademark that disparages a racial group necessarily disparages individual members of that group. The court then observed that Section 2A applies not just to disparagement of persons, but also to disparagement of beliefs or institutions. A narrow interpretation of person would be at odds with the application to beliefs, an extremely broad and fuzzy category. This part of the opinion was joined by every justice except Justice Thomas. We'll return to him later. With this theory out of the way, Justice Alito moved on to the First Amendment arguments. The opinion begins by addressing several reasons that the government claimed trademark registration falls outside the First Amendment's protection. First, the court considered whether trademark registration should be considered government speech rather than private speech. The court notes that the marks registered by the PTO are privately created, and there is no effort to make sure they align with government policy or are consistent with other registered marks. In Alito's words, quote, "If the federal registration of a trademark makes the mark government speech, the federal government is babbling prodigiously and incoherently." And, the court says, the government can't muffle opposing views by placing its seal of approval on private speech and therefore turning it into government speech. Perhaps most interesting about this portion of the opinion is the way the court discussed Walker v. Sons of Confederate Veterans. As I noted earlier, in Walker, the court, in a 5-4 decision, upheld Texas's viewpoint-based rejection of a specialty license plate, finding that the specialty plate was actually the government speech, over a strong dissent written by Justice Alito. Here, Alito rejects the government speech theory, touching on some of the same themes from his Walker dissent, but this time his opinion is unanimous. In fact, even though five of the court's eight members were in the Walker majority, they all signed on to Alito's opinion saying that Walker, quote, likely marks the outer bounds of the government speech doctrine. But rejecting this argument is where the agreement on the court ends. Trademark registration isn't government speech, but what sort of First Amendment protection does it get? The court divides into two factions. Let's first look at the rest of Justice Alito's opinion, which from here on out speaks only for four justices, himself, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, and Justice Breyer. Having concluded that trademark registration is not government speech, Alito considers and rejects several other potential justifications for the disparagement bar. First, trademark registration is not a government subsidy. Although the government is able to pick and choose which messages it subsidizes, trademark registration does not involve a cash or equivalent payment to the recipient. In fact, the registrant pays a fee to the PTO. And inclusion in a government registry, even when registration confers benefits, has never been considered a subsidy for First Amendment purposes. Next, Alito's opinion considers whether trademark registration can be considered a so-called limited public forum, where the government creates a forum for speech but limits that forum to certain subjects or speakers. But even though the government can often limit the subject matter of speech in a limited public forum that it creates, it is prohibited from discriminating against speech on the basis of the viewpoint it expresses. Alito says that even if trademark registration is considered a limited public forum, the bar on disparaging marks is clearly viewpoint-based discrimination. Keep this in mind. We'll come back to this in a few minutes. Finally, Alito considers whether the disparagement bar is justified as a restriction on commercial speech. The government argued that because a primary purpose of trademarks is identifying goods and services in commerce, it should be considered commercial speech. Alito responded that even if trademarks are commercial speech, the disparagement bar is not sufficiently narrowly drawn to survive. The government asserts that the disparagement bar serves the important purpose of protecting the orderly flow of commerce, which it argues is disrupted by trademarks that disparage classes of people. But, Alito notes, the disparagement bar is far broader, covering disparagement of any group of people or belief, not just demographic classifications. Having found that none of the government's justifications hold up, Alito finds the disparagement bar unconstitutional. As I noted, for much of his opinion, Justice Alito was only speaking for four of the eight justices. So now let's take a look at what the other four justices thought. Justice Kennedy wrote a concurring opinion, joined by Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Kennedy argued that Alito's approach, addressing and rejecting each of the government's theories in turn, was unnecessary. Instead, for Kennedy, the heart of the case was the viewpoint-based discrimination. Kennedy addressed the government's argument that the disparagement bar is viewpoint-neutral because it applies uniformly regardless of who or what is being disparaged. Kennedy forcefully rejects this theory. To prohibit all sides from criticizing their opponents makes a law more viewpoint-based, not less so. The logic of the government's rule is that a law would be viewpoint-neutral even if it provided that public officials could be praised but not condemned. So, between the Kennedy and Alito opinions, all eight justices agreed that the disparagement provision was viewpoint-based and treated that as an easy question. This is significant because, as I noted earlier, the lower courts had not found this to be so obvious, and several had held that laws broadly restricting disparaging speech were viewpoint-neutral. Kennedy next addressed the argument that the disparagement provision is viewpoint-neutral because it applies equally regardless of the user's intent and depends only on the perceived effect on the audience. That is, Simon Tam's motives don't matter, only the fact that some find it disparaging. Kennedy rejected this argument, saying, "The government may not insulate a law from charges of viewpoint discrimination by tying censorship to the reaction of the speaker's audience." Kennedy endorses the wisdom of this rule, saying, "The danger of viewpoint discrimination is that the government is attempting to remove certain ideas or perspectives from a broader debate. That danger is all the greater if the ideas or perspectives are ones a particular audience might think offensive, at least at first hearing. An initial reaction may prompt further reflection, leading to a more reasoned, more tolerant position." For Kennedy, the very fact of the disagreement between Tam and the government over the social significance of the slant's name is evidence of how the government's approach would stifle debate. Kennedy concluded by briefly addressing a few of the government's other arguments. First, Kennedy noted that even if trademarks are regarded as commercial speech, viewpoint discrimination is still prohibited. And finally, Kennedy argued that the exception to the viewpoint neutrality requirement when the government is promoting its own speech is narrow and doesn't apply where the government isn't advancing a particular message, but is instead encouraging a diversity of views from private speakers. Justice Thomas also wrote a brief concurrence, making two points. First, Thomas noted that he did not join the opinion of the court on Tam's statutory argument that the disparagement provision applies only to legal persons and not to diffuse groups. Thomas argued that the court should not have considered this argument because it was made for the first time at the Supreme Court and was never presented to the PTO or the Court of Appeals. Second, Thomas noted his skepticism of the court's entire commercial speech doctrine, quoting one of his own prior opinions. "I continue to believe that when the government seeks to restrict truthful speech in order to suppress the ideas it conveys, strict scrutiny is appropriate, whether or not the speech in question may be characterized as commercial." So far, Thomas is alone on the court in arguing for altogether scrapping the commercial speech category, but the current Supreme Court has shown itself to be highly speech protective even in commercial speech cases, leading some commentators to suggest that, at least in practice if not in official doctrine, the court isn't really that far from Thomas's position. Those are the opinions in the case. So what are the rules binding on lower courts? That's actually a little difficult to say. When there's a clear majority opinion of the court, it's easy, but here there's no complete opinion joined by a majority. In a 1977 case called Marks v. United States, the court established the rule for dealing with such opinions, saying, quote, "When a fragmented court decides a case, and no single rationale explaining the results enjoys the assent of five justices, the holding of the court may be viewed as that position taken by those members who concurred in the judgments on the narrowest grounds." This is known as the Marks rule. But although it may sound straightforward on its face, just apply the narrowest opinion, in practice it's anything but. In the 40 years since Marks, the lower courts have struggled to apply it, coming up with at least three or four different methods of determining which opinion represents the narrowest grounds. Scholars who have written about the Marks rule have generally considered it incoherent, indeterminate, and illogical. But despite these practical and theoretical problems, the Supreme Court has shown little interest in clarifying its rule. This case is a good example of the difficulty. Which opinion is decided on the narrowest grounds? Alito's, which finds various government theories lacking, but never actually decides which legal rule applies to trademark registration? Or Kennedy's, which avoids delving into all of the tests addressed by Alito, but draws broad implications from a finding of viewpoint discrimination? It remains to be seen what the lower courts will make of these opinions. Given the fractured ruling, what does this case mean for First Amendment law? While it's unclear exactly which language the lower courts will take to be binding, there's quite a bit of common ground. First, as noted earlier, the justices were unanimous in rejecting the government's speech argument. This limits the impact of the 2015 Walker decision, which governments had been encouraging courts to interpret broadly. Second, both the Alito and Kennedy opinions endorsed a broad interpretation of what it means for a regulation to be viewpoint-based, which is significant due to the disagreement in the lower courts. On both points, the court continues its general trend of being highly speech protective. Notably absent from either opinion was any discussion of the void for vagueness argument, which was very prominent in the briefing. What are the practical effects of the decision? First, Tam gets his registered trademark on the Slants name, and indeed, only days ago, on July 27th, the PTO officially approved the Slants trademark for publication. The second immediate result was on the litigation over the Washington Redskins football team. In 2014, the PTO issued a decision canceling the team's trademarks using the Redskins name, citing the same disparagement provision challenged by Tam in this case. The Redskins' cancellation followed over 20 years of agency and court litigation by several groups of Native Americans, but the team's appeal of the cancellation was still working its way through the lower courts when Levy Tam arrived at the Supreme Court. The Redskins' case has been lurking in the background. After Tam petitioned the Supreme Court to take his case, the Redskins filed an amicus brief urging the court to instead wait for the Redskins' case to make its way to the court. After Tam's case was accepted, the team filed an amicus brief supporting Tam's position, which was cited in both Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy's opinions. It was clear that a win for the Slants in this case would almost certainly also mean a win for the Redskins, and that is indeed what happened. Shortly after the court's decision in Mattel v. Tam, the Native American litigants who brought the challenge to the Redskins' name, as well as the Justice Department, which had been supporting them, conceded defeat. Looking beyond the Redskins, according to reporting from Reuters and NPR, among others, following the court's decision, a handful of applications have been filed seeking to trademark various racial slurs. So far, at least, it appears that most, if not all, of these applications were filed by persons seeking to reappropriate the terms in a positive light or seeking to secure trademarks in order to preemptively block a similar move by bigots. It's not clear whether this represents a real trend or is just a blip following the publicity of the court's decision. Another interesting question is what effect this opinion will have on trademark law beyond the disparagement provision. Section 2A of the Lanham Act, which contains the invalidated disparagement provision, has another provision that prohibits registration of any mark that, quote, consists of or comprises immoral, deceptive, or scandalous matter. The court's decision in Mittal v. Tam doesn't say anything about the immoral, deceptive, or scandalous matter provision, but commentators have noted that much of the court's reasoning concerning viewpoint-based speech restrictions would apply equally to supposedly immoral or scandalous marks. It seems likely that going forward, applicants whose trademark registrations are rejected under this provision will bring legal challenges to its validity. Perhaps the more interesting question is whether this opinion will have any effect on more central trademark doctrines. One particular area to watch is the doctrine of tarnishment, which prohibits the unauthorized use of a trademark in a manner that devalues it by placing it in a negative context, even if there's no direct competition or consumer confusion. This frequently involves the use of a trademark in a sexual context that the mark's owner believes reflects badly on its brand. After Mittal v. Tam, it seems like an open question whether a finding of tarnishment involves impermissible viewpoint-based discrimination. Both Alito and Kennedy note in their opinions that they are not expressing a view on other aspects of trademark law, so we'll have to wait for future cases to resolve these questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
And that brings us to the end of Episode 11. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. You can leave a comment on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. Your feedback is appreciated. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Counting to 5 to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 is not available in your favorite podcast app, directory, or service, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Finally, if you like Counting to 5, please consider supporting us financially. Go to Counting to 5's Patreon page at patreon.com/countingto5, where you can make a recurring monthly pledge in any amount starting as low as $1. There's no long-term commitment and you can discontinue your pledge at any time. Patrons can get exclusive rewards, including special mini-explainer episodes, live video chats, bonus audio content, and more. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.